Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. If you are feeling ill at ease about the future of planet Earth, author and naturalist Diane Ackerman is here to tell us there is room for optimism. In her new book, The Human Age, The World Shaped by Us, she explores the ways people are shaping the modern world and argues for a new understanding of our relationship with the environment and our own bodies. And we welcome Diane Ackerman to this week's book show. Thank you so much for being with us.
Lovely to be with you again.
You note very early in the book that this came out of a series of questions, and I'm interested in what brought you to those specific questions.
I began to realize in only the past 200 years, really, the human race has just become the most powerful force of change on the whole planet. And that's really been creating a very exciting but also bewildering new reality for a lot of us environmentalists. Our relationship with nature is changing, the nature inside of us and the nature all around us. And this is happening to such an extent that many scientists are even talking about changing the name of the era in which we live. That would convey that dominion better, the human age. And when I started really looking at all the different facets of nature, how we relate to animals, how animals, even in our backyards, seem to be migrating earlier, different animals are showing up, I realized that there were just so many puzzles. It was a very confusing time to be alive.
Some of the questions that you include are, why is this the first year that Canada geese didn't migrate from many New England towns? What sort of stewards of the future planet will today's digital children be? How will cities, wild animals, and our own biology have changed in 50 years? And they seem very disparate at first, and yet they are all very connected, aren't they?
They are very connected. They all have to do with how we have been shaping the planet to suit our desires and our needs. We humans have been pretty busy meddling creatures. We've changed the course of rivers. We've changed the outlines of continents. We've made Oz-like cities. We've gone off the planet, for heaven's sakes. We've created all kinds of industrial, medical, scientific marvels. We've changed everything. You know, it's not just niche building like other animals do and like we used to do. To generally vex and bother every plant and every animal on every continent and in every ocean, that's another magnitude of nichecraft altogether. No other creature that has ever lived has had that kind of power. And on the one hand, we really should be very impressed. We have become a very majestic species. We've even begun adding extensions to all of our senses. We think it's normal now for humans to fly across the sky at 500 miles an hour or race down the highway at 60 miles an hour or do giant computations at speed or see things by just putting on glasses and contact lenses that our ancestors never could. We have a lot of prosthetics in our lives, and we don't think that they make us unnatural. We have changed who and what we are. I think we should be absolutely astonished that we started out so humbly and have achieved so much. But it is ironic that at precisely this time when we've mastered the planet, we are starting to discover that we might be endangering our own futures as a result. And that we do have to address right away.
You make the case in the book that what we've done is create a human environment in which we have embedded nature. I guess I'm interested in that balance, doing that, which you say is, yes, astonishing. But many would also look at that and say, okay, but what is our footprint on this planet? And have we, to be somewhat flip, screwed things up in the process?
There's no doubt. We've created a lot of planetary chaos that we didn't mean to. What's really important to remember is that we've done it accidentally. That part is vitally important. We have all of the talent and the tenacity and the technology that we need to change the world again, but this time on purpose and for the better. We're not helpless. We're not powerless. Human beings are very imaginative, strong-willed problem solvers. And the one thing we can't afford to do is wallow in denial or despair or depression, because that's not going to accomplish anything. We need to believe in ourselves and think positively and roll up our sleeves and get busy. And if we need any inspiration, you can look at all of the extraordinary projects that countries and individuals are doing all over the world every single day. It is really amazing. For example, the Prime Minister of India recently announced that he's transitioning 400 million people to solar and planting 2 billion trees along all of the highways. Trees are an absolutely wonderful thing, and it's something that we can do as individuals. Get out there and start planting a tree or 6 or 12 or 100. Those 2 billion trees are not only going to suck up carbon dioxide and store it in the ground, they're going to employ about 300,000 people who are out of work and create wildlife corridors that are desperately needed and give the commuters a sense of being embraced by nature. They are performing many wonderful services. That's just something that one leader is doing. In our own country, the EPA has regulations now that it wants in place on capping the carbon emissions and a tax on carbon and lots of other things, and we need to get behind them and say, yes, that's what we want to do. The march, People's March, showed that this is really in the forefront of everyone's mind and that they are willing to get out there and make the changes that they want to see in the world. I think that we can and should be very, very positive about things. It's very easy to feel gloomy when you look at the climate headlines or some of the doom and gloom environmentalists, what they're saying. And it really isn't true. We're all looking at exactly the same numbers, the same science. But depending on if you're an optimist or a pessimist, you draw completely different conclusion from it.
And you seem to be maybe not an optimist or a pessimist, but would take a philosophical view with this and look at it on a long, long geological scale. You are all for renaming the era that we are in.
I really am. It's not just going to be a change in terminology. And by the way, I think it almost certainly will happen by 2016. We should start getting used to it. All the textbooks will have to be changed and schools will be teaching that we live now in this human age. What it will do is help us nourish a new understanding of what we have accomplished, but also what we need to fix up. The UN panel on climate change has said that, yes, climate change is serious. It's urgent. We need to stop it from getting any worse right away. There are some aspects of it that are probably irreversible. Ice sheets will continue melting for hundreds of years and so on. But there is a great deal that we can do to really curb it. And they added that technologically, we are able to do that right now. Whether or not it's politically feasible is a different question. And that is something that we all have to decide. And that's why the peaceful activism that we have seen taking place all over the world is so very important.
In the book, you make a very interesting point that perhaps for many of us, most of us, that in growing up, we felt that we were peripheral to nature, that there was nature and there was us. now you make the case that we are ultimately designing our future and designing the nature that we want to live with.
Isn't that remarkable? For one species to create so much commotion, but also to be able to get to the point where it can design its own future, its own evolution. And we are changing the evolution of all of the plants and animals around us and of ourselves. I think that is really quite remarkable. And even when I was a student, we nature lovers and environmentalists believed that nature was pristine, that it was a kind of paradise, that it was untouched, and it was very important that it stay that way. What we now know is that there is not an inch of nature on the entire planet that has not been touched by us. Nature is still natural. That's a question that I think about in the book in one chapter. It is still natural. What it is not is other. We have become so ingrained with every aspect of nature that whenever we touch nature in any thread, it can have consequences to our way of life and our health. And even those places we've set aside and we think that they are pristine, they're really not. Climate change is causing a lot of different effects among the plants and animals. We need to try everything we can. I don't think one fix is going to do. And I don't think one version of nature is going to do either, because it's a more complicated problem as we come to understand who and what we are as a species. We need areas that are national parks, including ones that are in the ocean. And we also need ones where we are hands-on. Creating, for example, I mentioned wildlife corridors. Well, we've paved over the range of so many different animals that they're going extinct. And we need to help them go around our cities, go through our cities, and continue the migrations that they historically have had and the feeding grounds and all of that. And there are a great many places in the world where there are green belts that are being built for exactly that purpose.
It is a moral dilemma in some ways. You say in the book that we've jumped the line a bit. We've kind of butted our way into this. And I wonder about the moral aspects, because in some ways we looked at this and said, okay, well, God is doing this, and now suddenly we've become God.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And as Stuart Brand said, okay, we have become gods. We had better get good at it, you know. We better pay attention to what exactly we're doing. For example, let's just look for a moment at genetic engineering. We certainly do want to be able to, let's say, remove the cancer gene from the genome of Tasmanian devils, because there are very few of them left alive and they all have facial cancer, and that gene has been identified, and that would save them as a species. On the other hand, do we really need to have tomatoes that have the genes of salmon? Do we really need to have pets that fluoresce green, but you can buy them? We need to be careful now more than ever, because we're much better able to change the world than we are to understand it. Our power has grown faster than our wisdom. And you said it's immoral. Question. I agree with you. It really is. It's the great moral collision, really, of our era. I've been fortunate enough to live through many such. There was integration, women's rights, the Vietnam War looming over absolutely everything, apartheid, gay rights. There's a long list of them. In each case, those were the kinds of moral tumults that caused laws to change. And this will also. There will be a lot of changing of laws all over the planet.
Diane Ackerman is the author of the new book, The Human Age, The World Shaped by Us. It is published by Norton. You make the case in the book that we are nature. You liken us really to termites.
Well, why not? We are super organisms. Really, and we're learning more and more that, well, for example, we have 10 times as much bacterial DNA than human DNA. Oh, my. We don't see that. We appear to be whole. You see a friend walking down the street and you don't see teeming protozoas and bacteria and so on. The truth is we really are social organisms, superorganisms who belong to a species that is a superorganism, that belongs to a planet that's a superorganism. And termites build mounds, we build cities, but they both are examples of niche building, just the way beavers fell trees and in the process dislodge or kill some plants and animals in order to build their huts. We do that on a much, much more complicated scale with our cities. But we shouldn't see ourselves as separate from nature. We are nature in everything that we do. Is nature. We happen to be the most unusual life form that has ever existed on this planet. And I very much doubt we're going to find one like us on other planets. They may be, well, smarter or more technological in different kinds of ways, but they won't be exactly the same. We are unique. We should be proud of that. And we should use the extraordinary skills that we have, including our skills of empathy and compassion, to help the most vulnerable among us adapt and to design new ways to ease climate change. To a large extent, our inventiveness got us into this mess, and we can refocus it to help invent solutions also. And there are a lot of individuals around the world who are tackling these problems in very clever ways. I don't mean to suggest that we just need techno fixes. Right. We're also going to need to modify our behavior. Remember VISTA? I think it would be very helpful to have a combination VISTA, AmeriCorps, that has an environmental focus so that kids, when they get out of high school, they're not really super ready to go to college anyway. Why not give them the chance to spend a year working for the environment and have some of their college paid for as a reward? I think that could be very helpful.
I'm curious as to your thoughts on how other species are dealing with this as well. And I was struck by an image on the book jacket, because it's a beautiful book jacket for the human age. Without describing it in full to radio listeners, there is one part of the image which is a chimpanzee with an iPad. And I think, okay, well, there is the nature of us, the human nature, and how we have changed. So how possible is that, okay, these other species are rapidly changing as well because of us, because of their own transformations. So, yeah, we have to see what they're up to as well, right?
Yes, other species have had to go through evolutionary changes and cultural changes if they wish to live with us. Spiders in the cities grow bigger than spiders in the country because of our artificial light. They get takeout food brought right to them. Birds grow shorter wingspans in the cities so that they can dart around the traffic. Animals adopt our schedules of night and day. All of that changes. But we also have pretty much chosen which creatures we want to share the planet with. Now we have become, through our technology, more and more aware of the minds of other animals, and that some of them really are quite intelligent. Quite a lot of them share our emotions. So, for example, orangutans are very smart. They're extremely endangered. Their forests in Indonesia are being destroyed and rebuilt with palm plantations. And the few that are the ambassadors of their species that are in zoos, we worry about, because how can we enrich their lives? They have the IQ of children, of human children. So one of the things that Orangutan Outreach has started is Apps for Apes. They give iPads to great apes,
right,
so that they can do things like Skype. This one in Toronto Skypes. I don't know how to Skype, but he can Skype. They can play piano and games, and they're not as obsessed with the technology as we are. So maybe they're wiser in some ways, but they certainly can use them. And Peter Gabriel is even in the process of putting together an interspecies internet so that a number of intelligent animals can communicate with each other and with us. They're very soulful. When you meet them,
yeah,
as I say, they're like human children in what their mental abilities are like, and they will look at you very knowingly. Mind you, they've picked up a lot of our culture, so they're not exactly wild, but they have to be ambassadors of their species. The same is going to be, in a weird way, true of animals we de-extinct. You know, a moment ago we were talking about genetic engineering, and there is the frozen ark. The frozen ark is a doomsday place where they store the DNA of all of the animals on the planet. In theory, they can either enrich the gene pools of animals whose numbers are dwindling, or they could de-extinct, is the term, animals like the woolly mammoth. And the idea is that the embryo would be implanted in a female elephant who would carry it to term. Well, of course, this would be, you know, quite a surprise for the elephant when it gave birth and there was a woolly mammoth.
Woolly mammoth, right.
And culturally, it would be very different. The cultural influence is enormous. We know now about ourselves that our brains wire when we are children in response to all of the different interactions with the people around us and the experiences we have, and that's true for other animals too. So it would be a woolly mammoth, but not exactly.
I do want to discuss with you this idea of invasive species, because we think of some invasive species as plants and animals that are unwanted, that we have introduced. But you make the point that your rose bushes are invasive, that horses are invasive, that we have brought these things, and I likened it, I was thinking of this as I was reading this in the book, that to me it's a lot like the squirrel at the bird feeder. We want to feed the birds at the feeder, and yet when the squirrels come up to eat, we get upset and we want to shoot them. And
yes.
And I don't quite understand that. If we want to feed nature, then why don't we feed all of the nature? We tend to pick and choose.
We really are very, very picky about things. And we are the most invasive species of all, of course. But having said that, we have chosen the plants and animals that we prefer. And some we regard as pests, and some we regard as gifts. So my magnolia tree, I think, is an absolute dish. I just love my magnolia tree, but it's not really native to where I am. And there are lots of other animals, snakes and amphibians, and there's a coyote that comes up to the bird feeder, not just squirrels, and lots of other animals that have kind of worked their way, and we consider them pests. But apples we've chosen. Dandelions were brought over on the Mayflower. You know, they thought it would be nice to have them. And poison ivy, some people took back to Europe, people who were not allergic to it, obviously, because they thought it was beautiful. We move plants and animals all over the planet.
I love that line. My magnolia tree is an absolute dish. That's a wonderful line. So again, and I guess this goes back to the beginning, you are optimistic, but I think also there is not skepticism but concern that we if anything, we have great responsibility.
We do have great responsibility. With all of our achievements comes responsibility. We positively can make a difference and make sure that the future generations have a much better world and don't have to worry about, not being here at all, for one thing. But we don't have to feel doomed. We live on an absolutely gorgeous planet. It is a rare oasis in space. It will continue being that way if we decide to work together to take care of it, to work together as one species.
Diane Ackerman's new book is The Human Age, The World Shaped by Us. It is published by Norton. Diane Ackerman, it's always a great treat to speak with you. I thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you. It's a great treat to speak with you, too.
Thank you very much. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Thanks to Cornell University for their studio support. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.